Now the only thing to check is whether we have this stemming. S41. It's working. Good. Good. Hmm? Can you please close the door?
Okay.
Yeah. So the system wants us to be in the darkness. Unfortunately, there is no way of turning off on the light. Maybe.
But not in this room. So sorry.
Okay. The last part of our big topic, anomaly detection, is the machine learning methods. So that's what we are going to talk about today. First, we explain some machine learning essentials. Most of you have already been exposed to some kind of introduction to machine learning, I'm sure of that. However, we are going to make a short summary of these concepts. Then, of course, the rest will be about how we apply machine learning in anomaly detection. So that's the second part of our lecture, and then some details of this procedure of machine learning, like feature selection, what are the training algorithms, what are the classifiers. Then we do give two examples of anomaly-based IDS that have been published, let's say, explained in practice. And then finally we are going to talk about deep learning, which is a new trend in classification. So everybody is talking about deep learning, so we are going to see how this is used in intrusion detection. But first things first, we have said that intrusion detection systems can be considered systems with learning or training. And they're usually classified in two categories, good or bad, or normal or abnormal, traffic or logs, whatever we classify. Now, especially if we are talking about anomaly detection, which we are talking about now, usually we talk about two classes, because if we want details, then we have to classify into more classes, and then you cannot expect that the attacks will be 100% identified, as is the case with misuse detection. However, this is what we are interested in at this moment. So normal and abnormal, and in the rest of this talk, we are going to talk mostly about two classes. Now, machine learning, we have seen before when we talked about clustering, so that's called unsupervised machine learning. It's also machine learning. However, we do not learn. What we do here is finding similarities, intrinsic similarities between feature vectors. Then we group the vectors according to these similarity measures that actually are given in advance. So we discussed that previously, last lecture. Then we have unlabeled data. Okay, so we have measurements, our feature vectors. We don't know whether they are good or bad. We use the similarity measure between these feature vectors and classify them according to these similarity measures. So we have seen that it may be useful. However, we cannot expect that it is so accurate or as accurate as when we do it with learning, with supervised learning. In this case, we are going to talk about learning by example. There are other kinds of learning, like reinforced learning, etc. We are not going into these details. Learning by example is something that we do from when we are born. So we are given an example, and it is said, for example, this is red color, this is blue color, this is green color. So we show a lot of examples and assign each example, let's in this case a color, and then afterwards we present some color, and the baby actually classifies this color as blue or green or red. So this is something like that, so in roughly speaking. So we have labeled training samples in this case. So we call that supervised learning. Now, in machine learning systems, there are two phases. The first phase is training, where the system learns based on some training data that are presented to the system and based on what we call background knowledge. We are going to explain what background knowledge is. So we need training data, that's obvious. And then we need background knowledge. We are going to explain what it is, but we also need that. So that's the input in the training phase. Then the output of this training phase is what we call a model, based on training data and this background knowledge. So we build a model for this training data. And that's new knowledge acquired by means of the training algorithm from these two inputs. Now, that's the first phase of making a machine learning system work. Now, the execution phase, or testing, how it is called in machine learning concepts, it's testing, where we present some color, as we said in that example, and the system has to guess which color that is. And this guess is not pure guess, it's based on training. Okay? So, something similar to guessing colors. So we use the model that we have built on training data and background knowledge to classify the instances, we call them instances, the examples that we give to the system into, in our case, good or bad. Now, the model is also called hypothesis, very often, sometimes theory, but hypothesis is the concept that is used very often for this model. What is a model? Model is an abstraction of data. Okay? It explains the training data and background knowledge, which are inputs to building this model. That's the training procedure. Now, what is background knowledge? We said that we were to explain what background knowledge is. In machine learning, background knowledge is space of possible models. So you can build many models based on the training data. However, some of them are good, some of them are bad. Okay? Based on this training. So a space of all possible models or hypotheses, or this is called hypothesis space, that's one part of this background knowledge. The other part is the criterion. Okay, so how do we say that this model is good or this model is bad? So for this we need an optimality criterion, which determines which model from the space of all these possible models, or hypothesis space, is the best for the training data. So there is no the model that is best in general, but given the data, what is the best model? So for this we need an optimality criterion. So this is background knowledge. So to train, we need background knowledge and we need training samples. So we are also going to explain some basic concept, basic terminology, more, it's better to say, in machine learning. First of all, what is the instance and what is the instance space? So the points determined by the selected features are the instances, that's how they are called. So this is bold, which means a small x is a vector. So this vector is an element of the instance space, capital X. Okay? So the points, small x, in bold, are determined by the selected features. For example, CPU usage, memory usage, network usage. So these are three dimensional vectors that we measure at some time instances. So we get many vectors, and all of them, they belong to this instance space. Now, instance space can be finite if we are lucky, and infinite if we are not lucky. Even if we are lucky that this X is finite, this dimension can make it huge. For example, in the binary case, if we only have binary vectors that make this instance space, so we have binary instances from all zeros to all ones, say that n is small, like 5, then we have 2 to the power of 5 possible instances, okay? But if we have 41, that will be 2 to the power of 41, which is 10 to the power of 13, which is very, very large number. And this is usually the case, unfortunately. And unfortunately, the vectors are not binary. They may be, let's say, a bit more complicated than binary. Could be ternary. Okay? So if you have 0, 1, or 2, then you have 3 to the power of 5 in the case of 5. Okay? Etc., etc. And besides, not all the features may be of the same, from the same alphabet, so to say. Then it is more difficult to compute, but still it's finite, but it's a huge number. So we are dealing with a huge number even if we have finite instance space. Okay? Now, if we are not lucky, then, like in our case, CPU time, memory usage, network usage, these are real numbers from 0 to 1 percentages, which means that this space is infinite. So there are infinitely many instances possible. So that's the instance space. Now the label space is the classes, in our case. If we are talking about discrete label space, that's classification. Okay? If we are talking about continuous label space, that's regression. We are not going to talk about regression in this course, even though regression is very important in general. So in regression, we are not classified. We are trying to predict a continuous value of a function whose analytical expression we don't know. Okay? Based on known values of independent variables, some instances, from training. Okay? So you have training, and then you have to predict the next value of this function whose analytical expression we don't know. That's called regression. So for this course, it's not relevant. What is relevant is classification, where the label space is discrete. In our case, for k equal to 2, two classes, good or bad. Okay, so we have label space consisting of 0 and 1. Or 1 or 2, or how you call them. So we have shown the instance space, we have shown the label space. Now, we have to explain why machine learning is non-parametric, which means we don't consider the distribution of data, as was the case in our first lecture. If you remember, in our first lecture on anomaly detection, we consider parametric methods where the distribution of data is known or assumed. Now, why machine learning is non-parametric? We have to explain, to explain this, we have to explain what is called the optimal bias decision rule. So how do we classify if we know the distribution? Okay? We are going to explain that on the simplest case with two classes, where the label space is 0, 1. Okay, k is equal to 2. Then we need two distributions. We need prior probabilities of classes, p of 0, p of 1. What is the probability that any instance is put into the class 0 or into the class 1? So that's one distribution. Then we have the feature vectors x. These are our measurements. For example, CPU time, memory usage, network usage, three-dimensional feature vectors. And we take these measurements, and then we need the distributions of these measurements as well. Okay? What is the probability that if the class is 0, if the vector is put in the class 0, what is the probability that it is exactly the vector with some particular values of CPU usage, memory usage, and network usage? And the same for the class 1. So for each possible instance, we need these conditional probabilities. Okay? Now suppose that we know this, that we are given the prior probabilities or a priori probabilities of classes P of 0 and P of 1, and that we are given these conditional probabilities P of x if 0 and P of x is if 1 for all x. So this is parametric, remember, so because we know the distribution. Okay, now if we know the distribution, what we need is actually what is the probability of class 1 if we are given some x. Or, and what is the probability of class 0 that x is put in class 0 if we are given x. So remember, this is not the same as P of x if 0. So we are actually interested in the opposite case. What is the probability of 0 if x? Now this obviously yields that we use Bayes theorem. So if you remember, that's what you learned in secondary school. If you forgot, we are going to recall that now. So these probabilities, these are a posteriori or posterior probabilities of the classes. Okay, so to summarize, we are given two distributions, P of 0, P of 1, that's one distribution, and these conditional distributions, P of x if 0, P of x if 1, for all x. Now, given these two, we can, by means of Bayes' theorem, compute P of 1 if x and P of 0 if x. And whichever is greater, we put x into that class. So that's the optimal Bayes' decision. Why it is optimal? We are going to show the proof of optimality. So these posterior probabilities, they are actually updated a priori probabilities given the observed data. So all this, P of 0, P of 1, and these P of x if 0, P of x if 1, they are known before x is presented to the system. Now, once we present x, some measurement, CPU usage, memory usage, network usage, to the system, to the classifier, it decides by computing by means of the Bayes' theorem, P of 1 if x and P of 0 if x, it is possible knowing these. Okay, now these two distributions, we are going to see that. Well, if you remember Bayes' theorem, you already know that, but we are going to show that on the next slide, how we compute P of 1 if x and P of 0 if x. So we actually update these a priori probabilities given the observed data and do the classification. Whichever is greater, we put this x into that class. That's Bayes' decision rule. Now, the Bayes' theorem, of course, we need total probability of some vector x. It is probability of the class times the probability of x if 0 plus the probability of the second class times the probability of x if 1. Okay? So these are the distributions that are known. So we know that in advance. Then, once you know this for each x, then, given x, you can compute P of 0 if x this way. So this is the denominator, that's the total probability. And the numerator is P of 0 times P of x if 0, that's for the class 0, and P of 1 times P of x if 1 for the class 1. So that's Bayes' theorem, pure Bayes' theorem from the secondary school that you have learned. Now, obviously, if you know this distribution, you can compute these two values, given x. Now, where to put x? To the class 0 or to class 1? It depends on which of these two values is greater. That's the Bayes' decision rule. Now, the question is, why we call it optimal Bayes' decision rule? So why is this optimal? So why no other decision rule has a smaller probability of error? So optimality depends on error. So when is the error smallest? So for two classes, it's easy to explain. So this is the proof. The classifier receives x, some measurement, CPU time, memory usage, CPU usage, memory usage, network usage, that's one feature vector, for example, in our IDS. And it will decide 0, the class 0, based on the posterior probability P of 0 if x, if P of 0 if x is greater than P of 1 if x. Now, these are probabilities, which means that the classifier may make a mistake, in which case it is the error. So it should be put in the class 0, but it is for some reason put in the class 1. So that's the error. There are no other possibilities. Okay? And for the class 1, the same. So it can be put in the class 0, which is the error. And this, when you sum for all x's, since there are no other possibilities for computing the error, nothing else can be better. Okay, so this is the minimum error. So that's exactly the bias decision. So to minimize the error probability for all x, we have to decide exactly based on this maximum posterior probability. Now, if we have more than two classes, this is, of course, very easily generalizable, since bias theorem is easily generalizable to more than two classes. So, this was when we know the distribution. Okay? So, we know the distributions P of 0, P of 1, and we know the distribution P of x if 0, P of x if 1. And based on this, we compute P of 0 if x and P of 1 if x, and decide whichever is greater, we put that x into that class. So if we know these distributions, these prior probabilities, then we don't need machine learning. Because machine learning is presenting the examples and that are labeled in advance and train the system to build a model based on these examples. So why should we do that? When we know the distribution, we just compute P of 0 if x and P of 1 if x and compare them. So we don't need any machine learning. But that would be parametric anomaly detection. You see? Parametric decision because we know the distribution. Now, what is the problem? The problem is that we don't know these distributions. Okay? So who will give you these probabilities? That's low probability that you get these. Because of that, how can we classify in such case? We do machine learning. So, and consequently, this is non-parametric, because if it were parametric, then we would not need machine learning. We would know the distributions of data. So that's the first assumption in machine learning, that we do not know the prior probabilities of classes, and we don't know the probability, the conditional probabilities P of x if 0, P of x if 1, for two classes, and easily generalizable to more classes. Now, what is then the machine learning problem? The machine learning problem is like this. There exists some function, y is f of x is a vector, where x is from the instance space and y is from the label space. So, given x, we put it in the class 0, we put it in the class 1, but how? By means of this function f. This function is called target function. Target function is not known. We don't know the analytical expression. So if we knew the analytical expression for f, then given x, we would compute the label. Easy. So we cannot do that because we don't know this f. Now, the probabilities, which means the distributions, P of y, probabilities of classes, and P of x if y, probabilities of x if the class, they are not known either. So we cannot use a bias decision rule either. So we don't know the function f, we don't know these distributions. So what remains is, well, we can have some examples, like we measure CPU time, memory usage, network usage, and the experts say it will tell you this is good, this is bad, this is good, this is bad for another measurement. So some expert, so some abstract person or machine will tell you this is good or this is bad. So we would then have a training set. Okay, so this is used to learn the target function from examples. So target function is f, that we don't know. The examples are pairs. The measurements, the label. Okay, x, y. X is from the instance space, Y is from the label space. That's called training data. You will see we need a lot of training data. Now, we want to find the function g of x that is as close as possible to the unknown function f of x. G of x is then a model or a hypothesis. So g of x is taken from the hypothesis space. So we don't know f of x, but based on the training set, we build g of x that is as close as possible to f of x if this training set is representative. If it represents f well. Now, the hypothesis space is huge. So we saw that the instance space is huge. But the hypothesis space is even greater. Because in the discrete case, for example, here is an example. If we have only binary features, which is the simplest discrete case, only zeros or ones, so from all zeros to all ones, we have the instance space that is 2 to the power of the dimension. So in our case, 5 binary features in the instance space, we have seen that before, that's the cardinality of the instance space, 2 to the power of 5. Now we have two possible labels in the label space, normal or abnormal. So each of these, 2 to the power of 5, can be classified as good or as bad. In that case, what is the number of possibilities to map each of these vectors into one of these two possibilities? Obviously, 2 to the power of 2 to the power of 5, which is 2 to the power of 32, just for 5 binary features. You can imagine if you have 100 binary features, or if you have 100 non-binary features, even worse, how many of these functions would we have? So that's called hypothesis space. In our case, it is discrete. It can be infinite in the continuous case, non-discrete case. So hypothesis space is huge. So the instance space is huge, and the hypothesis space is even greater. So if you would like to find F by trying all the possible hypotheses, that's not possible, at least in practice. So it's impossible in theory if the instance space is infinite. It is impossible in practice if it is discrete because of the huge number of hypotheses that are possible. So you cannot just count all of them. That's not possible. There are too many of them. So, to find the model function g of x that is as close as possible to f of x, we only based this on training instances, which are pairs x and y. I hope that so far it has been clear. Now, we are going to give an example to explain all this in our realm of anomaly detection. Okay? The instance space X, suppose that we measure CPU consumption, memory consumption, network resource utilization. So these are three features that take values between 0 and 1 all inclusive. Okay? Of course, it's infinite because these are real numbers. So x1, x2, x3, our features, they are real numbers taking values from 0 to 1, any value. So the instance space is infinite. So these are vectors of dimension 3. Each dimension is a real number. Positive real number, of course. These are percentage, but still it is infinite. Now the label space is good or bad. So it's finite. Can be normal or abnormal. So we have the space Y is 0, 1. That's easy. Now what's the hypothesis space? Here on the left side we have all the possible, each point is one measurement. So it has three dimensions, X1, X2, X3. So there are infinitely many, obviously, of these. Each of them can be put either to the class 0, or to the class 1. It cannot be, there is no bifurcation from each point, otherwise it would not be a function. But many of these instances can be put in the same class. Still, it is a function. Okay? So that's surjection, x onto y. So that's mapping from x onto y. Now, how do we compute 0 or 1 given x? We don't know. So that's f of x, which we don't know. So, which means in practice that we never know precisely what is normal. So we can measure as many times as we want CPU usage, network usage, and memory usage, and we shall not be 100% sure that this measurement is normal. What we can do is take, say, 1,000,000 measurements and engage an expert that will say, this measurement is good, this measurement is bad, then use some classifier, train it on this training set, and build the model based on this data. Then when we present next measurement, then we can hope that this measurement will be classified correctly. So we are given a set of m observations, x and y is f of x. It's the labeled training data. Obviously, to get a labeled training data, that's actually expensive. So we have to engage some human that knows everything, okay? By means of the learning algorithm or training algorithm, we determine the model based on these observations, of these m observations that are labeled. This model, g of x, predicts the future values of the unknown function f of x well, which is determined by the background knowledge, which is the hypothesis space, and the criterion, okay, and the training data. The criterion is whether the hypothesis is good or bad. And the training data. So, this is what we are talking about is the explanation why the things work this way. Now, the very procedure, how the things work this way, is very simple. So, take the sample for training, and say, this is good, or this is bad, okay? So the system somehow memorizes that, and then you present the unlabeled sample, and it will determine, based on the previous training, whether this sample is good or bad. So this is how our IDS or any other classifier works. Here is an example on five vectors of dimension 3. So we have x1 is 02, 04, 01, so 02, 20% CPU, 40% memory, 10% network, and some expert says that it is good. So it's normal. And then x2 is 02, 03, 01, also normal. This one is bad, 05, 04, 01, it's bad, 07, 02, 06, also bad, 03, 01, 01, good, okay? Now, we train the system since we have the labels on these triples of values. We have the labels. Now, we can train some classifier and build the model g of x for classifying future data. Now, which method we use to get this model? Okay, based on only 5 points in this three-dimensional space, we can use a heuristic. Heuristic is by experience, okay? So heuristic is when an expert creates the model based on the training data by his or her experience. Of course, this doesn't work for high dimensions and a lot of points. However, we can use some methods that have been developed for this. Different classification methods represent different learning or training algorithms. For example, we have what is called Bayesian classifier. It's not Bayesian optimal decision rule. We don't know the distribution. But there is a classifier that is called Bayesian classifier. It is similar, something similar, but without known distribution. Then, multilayer perceptron, which we are going to focus on today, because most IDS that are that use machine learning actually use these neural networks. So you have heard of this, neural networks and now deep learning networks. Yeah? And many other. There we could use a semester to explain all this, or two semesters. But this is not a machine learning course. We just give you very, very basic information about machine learning in general. So in our example with 5 points, there are many acceptable models. We could use whatever. So in our case, heuristics. So let's try three. Well, two, more or less, two heuristics. One of them is, okay, we just based on X1, on CPU. We say if CPU time is smaller than 0.5, then it's normal. Okay? So this is one. Of course, the consequence of ignoring X2 and X3 will be that we shall have a lot of false alarms. So can we do it better? Okay, we can say it like this. If CPU is smaller than 0.5 and network is smaller than 0.5, then normal. Okay? Well, it's not precise enough either because we are ignoring X2. So we could, as the third one, say something like something similar. But to generalize all this, we can say that the first heuristic, it is almost certain that if X1 is low, instances are normal. We can freely say that just looking at our samples for training. Which means even training on a small number of instances, just 5, okay, it's better than a pure guess. So if we would not train at all, then it would be even worse. Okay? So this predicting of f of x would be even worse. Now, by training a certain number of label instances, what we have done, whatever kind of training we use, in our case we use some crazy heuristics, so we teach the anomaly-based IDS the definition of normal. Now, what if we want to define normality absolutely precisely? We would have to train the IDS on all the possible instances with all the possible hypotheses. Now, if the instance space is infinite, then it's obvious that the hypothesis space is also infinite, so this is impossible. So we have seen that. Our case with 3-dimensional vectors that are real features, 0 to 1, that's infinite already. So we cannot do this. So both instance space and hypothesis space in our case are infinite, and that's the case in 99% of the cases, especially in the IDS. So instead, we train the system on a large number of label instances, but representative. You see, why representative? Since the hypothesis space and the instance space are huge, then if we just train on a small number of instances just taken at random, and then we present some instances that are far away from these that we have trained, then the decisions will be wrong. So we need a lot of samples. Now, a human cannot do it. It's so tedious. You will see that training is just repetition of very simple operations, but billions of times. So you cannot do it by hand. But a computer can do it easily with eager. So that's actually the advantage of using computers, data-driven procedures. So we use a large number of representative label instances, and the more, the better. Now, how to get the label data sets? We said that it's expensive because you need millions of samples for which you engage an expert to say this is good or this is bad. It's difficult to find. Now, if we have some data set that is such, then this will substantially reduce the number of false positives, which is the goal of the training procedure. A machine learning anomaly detection IDS would look like this, schematically. This part, the upper part, is the training. That's the training part. And the lower part is testing, or classification, or execution of the IDS. So we build the IDS, actually, by building the model. And this model is based on the training data and the background knowledge, which is the hypothesis space and the criterion. And these are inputs to the learning algorithm or training algorithm that will build this model. Now, once you build the model, this is why this is dashed, okay? So we use the model that we have built to classify. Now, we have raw data, since this is an IDS, we have to extract the relevant features, what to measure from these all things that we could measure. We don't need to we shall see that when we talk about feature selection. Now, feature selection is not the same as feature extraction. Feature extraction comes after the feature selection. We first identify what features we are going to measure, like CPU, memory, and network. And then if we say these three are relevant, we measure only them out of all the parameters of the system that we could. Okay? Then we extract only these three features, for example, and then we use them as input to our classifier. And the classifier classifies by means of the model that was it was built based on the training data and the background knowledge. So the output is good or bad for this sample of whatever kind of features and the number. Then we extract only three in our case, in our example, and then we classify it in good or bad. So that would be a machine learning anomaly detection IDS. It works like that. It has the components, the training part and the testing part. In the training part, we have the training algorithm or the learning algorithm that takes the background knowledge, which is hypothesis space, and the criterion which of these members of the hypothesis space is good, is the best, and the training data samples to build a model on these data. And if these training data are representative, then the classification will work well. To be representative, we need a lot of training data. So why should we use machine learning in IDS at all? First of all, we learn by example. By this, we can detect new intrusions. This is very important. Zero-day attacks. Okay? Then a system using training or learning by example can adapt to new behavior, good or bad. So bad is malicious or benign. Now we can make signatures for a misuse detection system based on this. So these are three good reasons to use machine learning in IDS in general, not only anomaly detection. We can boost misuse detection by means of machine learning. So this is what we would like to have, machine learning, okay, in IDS. Now, how to do it? Now, we have explained how the things work, how these procedures work. We have explained the basic concepts. Now, we are going to explain how to perform this machine learning in intrusion or anomaly detection. First of all, we need features. So what to measure? Is CPU time, memory usage, or network usage, are these relevant? Well, somebody said yes. Okay? So do these three, for example, features characterize normality well enough? I wouldn't say so. However, this is a typical example. We are just illustrating things. Now, once we decide what to measure, then what are good algorithms to perform this anomaly detection? So how to train and how to test or execute. Okay, let's have a break, and then we continue with feature selection.
Yeah. I'll put it on the pizza.
Okay, let's start. So we stopped at feature selection. We are going to show why we need it. Well, the number of features determines the size of the instance space. Now, it's exponential growth of the instance space with the increase in the number of features. We have seen that if the instance space is discrete, but as well, if it is continuous, the same. So we add a feature, for example, in the binary case, we add one feature that doubles the instance space, etc., etc. That's terrible. So it's exponential growth. And the hypothesis space is double exponential. It's 2 to the power of 2 to the power if we are talking about binary. Now, that's when we add the feature. Now, if we remove the feature, then we get a lot, you see? So we gain a lot. So if we have, we are going to give an example. So feature selection, which means removing of some unnecessary features, reduces the size of the instance space exponentially. Since adding features increases the size exponentially, then reducing the number of features decreases the instance space exponentially. The consequence is that with the constant size of the training sample, which is very often the case, since it's expensive to get these training samples, so we cannot pay a lot of money. So say that we have money for 500 of such vectors, then 500, if we have a smaller number of instances, is actually much better to have than the same 500 if we have a lot of instances. Then we have much worse case for classification. Here is an example. If we consider the simplest case, binary instances, okay? Now, if we have 20 features that are binary, the size of the instance space is 2 to the power of 20, which is 1 million and something, okay? So we have 1 million possible instances. Now, if we have size of the available training sample just 500, then the ratio, you see, the ratio of the available training samples to this total number of binary instances is relatively small. Okay, so that's usually not enough to build a good model. Now, suppose that by some method, we haven't studied how we do it, but by some method we reduce the number of features to 10. Okay, then we just have 1,000 possible and something, 1,000 possible samples in the instance space. And now if we have 500 as before, then it's quite good. It's one half. So it's a good chance to build a good classifier. So that's the motivation for feature selection. Now the question arises, how do we get 10 out of 20 features? So that's another story. So how? We can remove irrelevant and redundant features of objects, in our case, of traffic, for example. Okay. We can do it in two ways. We do feature ranking or subset selection. Now, feature ranking, we rank features according to some criterion function and then select the first k. So if k is 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., etc., the smaller the better. And then we can do the other way around, subset selection. We select the minimum subset of features that can enable learning with minimum performance degradation, or at least no degradation if possible. Sometimes it's also possible to achieve. Okay? Now, how can we do that? In supervised way, where we do it on label data only. In unsupervised way, when we perform that on unlabeled data only, for example, with clustering. And the combination, semi-supervised, a small set of labeled data that is costly, you see, but it's a small set, so we don't pay much money for expert knowledge that is used for labeling, and a large set of unlabeled data, which is cheap. So semi-supervised sometimes give a good trade-off between the cost of the feature selection and the quality of features that we select. Now, what about the supervised feature selection? We try to find features that help class separation. So those that do not have effect on class separation, they can be removed. Now, there are algorithms for this, and for example, information gain we can use. So, better feature, greater information gain. So, it contributes to class separation better. And there are special algorithms like relief, relief effects, and we are not going into detail. So, if you are interested in that, there are books on feature selection only. So, there is a lot of theory behind this. So that was supervised, where you actually use trained systems. Now, unsupervised, if a feature contributes to cluster discrimination, it is relevant. Okay, so we do clustering many times. The procedure would be we choose some subset of features and then do clustering. Then after this clustering, we compute some cluster evaluation criterion, like if you remember Davis-Bolling index, or there are others like silhouette index, Dunn index, Hausdorff metrics, many things. So we can do that. And then we do again with other feature subset until we find, well, compute the same clustering evaluation criterion until we find the best one. And that's the corresponding feature set that is the best. Okay, so that would be unsupervised. Now, what is the complexity of this? It's 2 to the power of the number of features, obviously, because that's a partitive set. So we choose one feature, and then, so that would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, if we have 20, for example, and then 1, 2, 1, 3, 1, 4, etc., etc., and then 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 4, 1, 2, etc., etc. That would be 2 to the power of the number of features. So that's the partitive set. You know that from elementary mathematics. So that's a lot of running the clustering procedure. Now, semi-supervised or combined, we use a small labeled data set and a large unlabeled data set. Unlabeled data sets are cheap, as we said. Labeled data sets are expensive. We need a human to pay to give us the label. This is good, this is bad. Okay? But the obtained results are often better than those obtained with only unlabeled. Okay, so ideally we would use only supervised. That's the best, but that's expensive. So it's not possible to get huge data sets this way. That would be too expensive. So semi-supervised gives promising results. In intrusion detection, we usually use expert knowledge to select features. This can be subjective, of course, but we can use several experts and combine the results independently. Then this dominates in practice. That's called feature engineering. So how to get good features? Actually, in these systems, there are operators that spend time whose task is to select features continuously, which is obviously time-consuming, which is obviously costly, since you have to engage workforce on this. And this is highly qualified workforce. It's not just anybody from the street that can tell you this combination of features is good or bad. Now, can we do it in a more simple way? We can with this deep learning. We are going to say something in the end of this lecture on deep learning, which is a new trend in classification in general. So we either have a simpler feature engineering, or we do not need feature engineering at all with deep learning classifiers. However, with this, we need even more data. So we need huge amounts of data for training, which is not a problem for today's computer systems. And we have a lot of data that can be sampled. So this is realistic, as the practice shows. Now, result of this expert feature analysis is the features of the instances that are extracted from information present at different abstraction level, at least 2, low level and high level. It may be something in between, middle level, we are going to see that. Low level is easy to get, so these are packet data taken from the header, Okay, so source IP address, source IP port, destination IP address, destination port, some other things that are easily extractable. So that's called very often intrinsic data. We are going to see next week when we talk about test data sets that these are really called intrinsic features. So these are intrinsic data. So these are easily extractable from headers of packets. Now, we may have high-level abstraction data, which may be usually occurrences of suspicious strings. So we search for something in the packets, or some security level of the source and the destination, like reputation, something like this. So this is abstract. It's not very easy to find. So this is by experience in most cases. The set of features that is relevant for intrusion detection is often divided actually into three subsets. Intrinsic features, we have already mentioned them. These are low-level abstraction data. Traffic features and content features. So these content features are definitely high-level because we have to search for something extra from the payload, etc. Maybe traffic features. Usually statistics related to past connections. So how many connections in the last 2 minutes have accessed this port, for example? This is highly relevant because this may indicate some denial of service attack, etc. So this is traffic features. This can be considered either low level or high level. It depends on what feature we talk about. These intrinsic features, this is general connection information. So low level of abstraction, for example, duration, protocol type, flag set. So that's easy to extract from the headers. And some other things like this duration, you just measure timestamps, the difference in timestamps will give you this duration. They are used to detect some simple attacks that are based on header information only. These exist. Like SYN flood, something like that. So denial of service may be in this category. For example, normal traffic usually involves transmission of many packets, whereas attack traffic sessions are often short. So these are like this SYN flood. So that's the first category, intrinsic features. The second one, traffic features, these are statistics related to past connections. This is, let's say, medium level of obstruction. So that would be neither high nor low. So example, number of connections with the same destination host or destination port, I have already mentioned that, in a time window, like 2 minutes, 2 seconds, whatever, or within a predefined number of past connections, like the 100 past connections. You will see when we talk about these data sets that it was exactly how it was built, this data set. That we, one of the, this KDD cup that we have already mentioned several times, we are going to see how it was obtained. Now, if each connection alone does not constitute an attack, but they do in combination, we can detect that by means of traffic features. That's actually event correlation. Okay? And then we can define normality accordingly. Normal time window behavior. If in the last 2 minutes we didn't have like 10,000 connections to the same port, that should be good. Okay. Finally, the content features, that's high level, where we need information extracted from payload. For example, if it is root access attempt, now, well, we can say yes, but was it successful or not? It's not easy to find out this just from the header. We might search for something. It may not be just one packet, etc., etc. So we have to study the session, use some intelligence. So that's why it is high level. This can be used in misuse detection, of course, as well, since the content features include information characteristic for some attacks. And that's, as we said, why we need machine learning. We can build signatures based on this information, okay? So if, for example, we make a criterion, was it 30 attempts to to guess a password or something like that. So why 30? Because that was obtained from learning, from training. Also, normality can be defined by. This was misuse detection, and it can be anomaly detection, like negative matching. If root attempt was not present, that's normal, okay, for this traffic. So not everybody accesses some web page as root on that web server. So that should be normal. Now, we can take various feature abstraction levels into account, not just one of these categories. We can use several classifiers for this, and each of them we train on partial feature information. For example, this is called multiple classifier approach to anomaly detection. We are going to see an example of this, where we use a battery of classifiers on content features, or a battery of classifiers on intrinsic features, etc., etc. And then we combine the results of these classifiers in a suitable way. Some of them will say good, some of them will say bad. We can use majority, for example. If the majority says good, then it's good. That's the decision fusion function. Here is an example. Suppose we have feature vectors, like 40 features, or 41, as we have in this famous KDD cup that we haven't explained yet. So some of them are intrinsic features, which means duration of the connection protocol that was used, so that's very easy to extract. And we can use these intrinsic features to train several classifiers, like N1 classifiers we have for this. Each classifier can be the same type but with different parameters, or it can be different classifiers, totally different, like neural network or deep learning network or some other not neural network. There are Bayesian classifier, whatever. Now, traffic features that can be extracted from traffic, so the number of past connections in the last 100 connections or in the last 2 minutes, etc., etc., another battery of classifiers for this, and two classifiers. And finally, the content features. So those that contain, for example, bad word in the packets. Okay, so we use another battery of classifiers for this, and three classifiers. Now, each of these classifiers will give the decision, good, bad, good, bad, good, bad. Now, we get many good and many bad decisions, okay? Now, we use some decision-making algorithm that, based on these inputs, good, bad, will finally decide whether it is good or bad. So, that's the conceptual schematic of such a system. Now, what will this decision function be? It can be majority voting. I have already mentioned that. So the majority says good, then it's good. Now, it can be average. Assigns the instance the class label with the maximum average posterior probability, P of 0 effects and P of 1 effects, if two classes. So we can do that. And we can do it, in more complicated way. We can use so-called belief functions. We are going into detail. So most of the time, the majority voting rule works very well. Now, that was about features, and it was about the conceptual classifier. Before we continue, well, one could ask, what kind of classifier is the best in general? Now, there is no answer. Actually, there is an answer that says there is no such a thing, and that's called no free lunch theorem. It's not so old, like 25 years ago, which says, roughly speaking, of course, you can read the paper, but I think I have uploaded that paper. It's very interesting. It's worth reading. So there is no single learning algorithm that outperforms all the others in all situations or on all the problems. So it depends. That's the problem with machine learning in general. Many times the results depend on the problem, and that's the worst of all. So consequence of this no free lunch theorem is that the design of a learning algorithm depends on the problem and many other factors, like how many training samples we have, etc., etc. Sometimes some algorithms perform well with a small number of training samples, which is good, actually. So the design of a good learning algorithm for a particular problem is a combination of art and science. And that's why we have here many classifiers. So this classifier may be good for some combination of features, this for some other. So we use different classifiers. And that's because of this no free lunch theorem. Because we don't know in advance for which data a particular classifier works well. Which means machine learning not only science, it's art and science. You must have some experience to apply machine learning methods on given data. Of course, how to classify, which classifier to use, there are many, many, many methods that have been tried. So this is a theory and practice that has been developed in the last, say, 65 years, something like that. So from the late 50s and on. Okay? So many algorithms have been tried, like gradient boosting, which is good for what we call non-perceptual problems, but our problems are actually perceptual. So we have data and we have to perceive whether it is good or bad. Yeah. So for this, there are good algorithms that are neural networks, and generalization of these networks are deep learning. There are also neural networks. We are going to explain them and focus on them in the rest of the theoretical part of this lecture, and the applications you will see there are. Now, there are others, like decision tree, random forest, support vector machines, kernel methods, Bayesian learning, unsupervised learning, and clustering as well, but we have studied that already, and some semi-supervised learning, combination of unsupervised and supervised. So, in the rest of the talk, we are going to consider neural networks. So, all these methods, neural networks, have been tried many times in concrete IDS problems. Okay? And they give relatively good results, but this cannot be generalized to all the systems and data sets. Sometimes other classifiers work better, so that's why we use other classifiers, so a combination of classifiers. What is good is that many of these classifiers, you can find them already implementing. There are many packages for this, and for example, TensorFlow is for neural networks, so that's Google. So I'm not announcing them as the best, but that's very often used. Hmm? And there are many others. So. And they are fast enough, neural networks, to support real-time IDS. So you will see these are so-called feed-forward neural networks. When executing, when testing, computing the output of such a network is fast. So let's consider neural networks. So we first explain the concept and then the very basic neural networks constituting of just one neuron, and then we extend that to several. Now, what are neural networks? They consist of a large number of interconnected processing nodes called artificial neurons that work in parallel. The output of each node is in general a nonlinear function of its inputs. So you will see it's a sum of products, etc. You will see. An input to an artificial neuron can be the value of a feature directly or an output from some other neuron. The connections between the artificial neurons are assigned weights. These are positive numbers, in general, real numbers. And neural networks can learn by example. That's why they are used. How does it work? You first give weights according to some rule to all these connections, and they are very often random weights and can be anything. Then you provide a training instance, and this modifies the weights of the connection. Then you provide another, etc., etc., until you are satisfied with training. So the weights that remain after the training, they are used in testing. So then they are not changed any longer in this model of learning. Now, what is a neuron? This is a neuron. That's a special function. It has inputs, n inputs. Each of them is assigned a weight, which is a positive real number, and the inputs can be negative. So x1, x2, to xn. The output is a function of the inputs xi and the weights wi. Now, this is very general. Now, to make one neuron as a classifier concrete, we can say that it's a perceptron. Now, perceptual problems, you remember, I mentioned that. So that's why it is called perceptron. So given axis, is it good or bad? Okay, so this combination of values for x, is it good or bad? That's what the perceptron will give you the answer for. So that's only neuron, one neuron. The output is sine function of the sum of the products of xi, wi. So this times this, plus this times this, plus this and this, that's the input sum, how it is called. Now this input sum is the input to this sine function. Sine function is 0, 1, or 1 or minus 1. It depends how you define it. 0, 1. So if it is just one neuron, it can be this perceptron. Now if it is more, then we are talking about feed-forward networks or recurrent networks or Hopfield networks. We are going to see what that is. Now feed-forward networks is what we are going to study in this course. So the outputs of artificial neurons in one, they are organized into layers. So the outputs of artificial neurons in one layer are fed into the nodes of the next layer. No feedback. That's why they are not recurrent. Okay? Now recurrent is that they have feedback connections. Now this sometimes can be good. However, it's difficult to train. It's difficult to understand their operation. In the case of feed-forward networks, it's easier to train and it's easier to understand their operation because you will see how they are trained, so-called backpropagation algorithm. So they are very often used in practice in any kind of things, and it's also in ideas. So now you have self-driving cars, you have many things so that use machine learning. So this is also used in ideas very often in practice. So this is like this. You see, you have in this particular example, you have three layers. So the first layer consumes the features. So the inputs are the features here. And then the connections can be complete. For example, this one, the first node in this layer is connected to all the nodes in the next layer. But this doesn't have to be so. It can be connected to a subset of the neurons in the next layer, etc., etc. Now, a recurrent network, similar, but you have some feedback, you see? So you can return the value to this, so why? There are some reasons. So this is complicated to train and complicated to understand. And the most complicated, but the best classifier, is Hopfield neural network. These were actually the first to be studied, which is interesting. So there, each neuron is connected to all the others. So it's not layered structure. So it's very complicated to train. It's complicated to understand how they function. However, the best results obtained with neural networks are with this. For example, this famous traveling salesman problem. You have n cities, and you have how many kilometers there are between to see each of the pairs of the cities. And then you start with in one city and you have to return to that city using the shortest path and visit all the cities. So that's an extremely difficult problem. It actually pertains to the class of so-called NP-complete problems. NP-complete problems are the most complicated that exist. So some of high-dimension traveling salesman problem instances are actually solved by means of such a network. How they have been trained, don't ask me. It's very difficult. So we are not going to consider that. It's art, not only science. What is the simplest is to train this. But we are going to explain only one algorithm that is used for training, and that's the most often used one. But you will see in deep learning it will be different. So let's start with the simplest one, with single neuron, which is a perceptron. So the training sample, we have pairs. This is CPU time, memory usage, network usage, and good or bad. Okay, so that's X is the vector, Y is the scalar. This is the class. Okay, X is an instance, Y is the class label. So we have a vector instance, three measurements in our case, and we say good or bad for many training samples. Okay, now the perceptron uses the initial weights that are random. Okay, and N is the dimension of this instance, X. Now we also use a positive constant C in training, not so large, to avoid swings. So how does it work, the training? We compute for given weights and the given features of the training samples. We compute the input sum for each of them. We use the signum function, which is 1 or minus 1. So 1 is if U is the input is greater or equal to 0, and minus 1 if it is negative. Now, if what we have computed, the output of the neural network, which is just one neuron, the output of the neuron is not the same as the label for this sample, then it's an error. So we have to adjust the weights. And this, how much we adjust the weights, these deltas, they are computed by means of the difference between the good estimate and the output of our neuron times the constant and times the corresponding input. Now, each time we present a sample, the label sample to the perceptron, we repeat the same procedure. Now, once we browse through all the samples, it's not done, the training. We have to repeat, because when you change one weight judged by this sample, this will spoil the previous results, okay? This effects may spoil the previous results. So we have to repeat the browsing through all the samples many times. Each such browsing through all of them is called an epoch, until we are satisfied, okay? Until we actually obtain that we have no error. So for none of these x's, we get that z is different from y. That's called convergence. So the procedure converges eventually. For all the problems that it can handle, just one neuron. So already in 1960, this author Rosenblatt, that was first to study this perceptron, he said that the procedure. So why is some neural network good? If it is good, only if the training converges. If you can, based on the training data set, get that there is no error for the given data set. So is it possible to have no error for any problem? Not with the perceptron. But that was showed 9 years later than this. So, you know, all these hypes, they go this way. So, first of all, somebody discovers something, okay? And then everybody hopes this is time, okay? And this is, let's say, hope. So everybody hopes that it will solve all the problems. The interest grows until we get to some maximum, and then there is disappointment. people notice that it is not possible to solve all the problems. However, we don't get to the zero level. We get to something better than that. So it converges to to a class of problems that this new hype can solve. So in 1969, this guy, Minsky, he actually proved that perceptron, just one neuron, works if the classes are linearly separable, which means if you can draw a line between the instances that belong to the class 0 and the instances that belong to the class 1. So there are many such problems that can be solved just by one neuron. However, not all. Typical example is a very simple problem, XOR problem. So you have the XOR function, you know what it is. So we have 0 plus 0, so this is the function, XOR. Okay? So 0 plus 0 is 0. 0 plus 1 is 1. 1 plus 0 is 1. 1 plus 1 is 0. You have something like this. So the classes are not linearly separable. You cannot draw a line between the class 0 and the class 1. Huh? Try. You will not succeed. So this cannot be trained by a perceptron. So the perceptron, given this problem, you give many instances. The instances are pairs. So you have a two-dimensional problem. So this is the dimension 1 is 0, 1, or n dimension 2 is 0, 1. And the result is 0 or 1. Okay? Now, you train. You say, I have 0, 0, the result is 0. I have 0, 1, the result is 1. I have 1, 1, the result is 0. Okay? Now, train. Will it converge? No, it will not converge. So this procedure will never end. So there will always be difference between for the given sample. So you can repeat as many epochs as you like. It will never converge. So that's the problem. So we cannot solve all the problems with one neuron. For this, we need more neurons. Of course, when we use perceptron, classification is easy. For the given instance, compute the output, and these weights are now fixed. So they are obtained by training once convergence was obtained. So with the weights WI obtained after the completion of the training procedure, so the output will be either 1 or minus 1 for the given testing vector. Okay, so we don't know the label, so it is not labeled, so we decide. So if it is 1, it is one class. If it is minus 1, it's another class. So this will work, for example, for AND. It will work for OR. So these binary simple functions can be trained this way. So you can use neuron instead of Boolean circuits, but not XOR. Now, since one neuron cannot solve all the problems, the question arises, which combination of neurons will solve all the problems? Now, it has been proved that three layers of a feed-forward neural network can actually solve any problem. So they are enough to represent any hypothesis. It doesn't mean that you will not need a lot of samples to train and that the procedure of training will not last days, for example, or even more. However, if you are patient enough and you have a good training data set, it will build a new good model for any problem. Now, the cardinality of the first layer in such a feed-forward neural network is equal to the number of features. So we have selected features by means of some procedure, and we said CPU time, memory usage, network usage, that's our features. So we have three features, which means that the cardinality of the first layer will be three neurons. Now, if we have two classes, normal and abnormal, in our IDS, we only need one neuron in the third layer. And in between, we have the second layer, which is called the hidden layer. With three layers, you see, three layers feed-forward neural network solves any problem. Now, the function z is not signum. It's sigmoid function in most cases, but there are others, like hyperbolic tangent. But sigmoid is most often used. For easier analysis and inference of a good training procedure, we use this threshold function, signum, in the output function of perceptron, but it is replaced now with the sigmoid function. It's smoother, you see. In perceptron is minus 1 or 1, which means that you have very sudden transition between the classes. So we need something smoother, and this is sigmoid function. Sigmoid view is 1 divided by 1 plus exponent of minus u. Now, homework, compute the derivative of this function. So obtain this. Why derivative? You will see it's very easy. Use the knowledge that you acquired in the mathematical analysis 1. It's very easy. So find the derivative. Derivative is given. You see sigma of u times 1 minus sigma of u. So that's homework. Why derivative? Because we need a derivative when we talk about finding training, how to train. And the sigmoid function looks like this. Now, what is the input to the sigmoid function? The input is the same as the input to the perceptron, you see. To one neuron, you have the input sum. So this is sum of input feature times the corresponding weight. So with the sigmoid function, we achieve that small changes in one of the weights results in small changes on the output of the whole network, which we want. This is desired behavior. Because if you remember perceptron, we needed a constant C to avoid swings between going from one class to another. We could actually skip the solution that gives the desired behavior. So if the function is smoother, the probability of that unwanted behavior is smaller. Still, we need some constants. We are going to see that. The output of the network is not just 1 or minus 1 because it is a real number, you see. So sigmoid function is a real function. It's not 1 or minus 1 or 1. It can be real value between 0 and 1, and during training we use these values as such. So we operate with real values, not with minus 1 or 1. During the classification, if we set a threshold. If the output is greater than 0.5, then one class, otherwise another class. So that's how we solve it after the training. How to train? That's a good question. And complicated answer. So we have to define an error function of the network. So the training is actually minimization of the error. So we tend to get as small error as possible on the given training data set. So it's the error is given the pair xy. So this is a training sample xy. So we compute z, which is the output of our network, and compute y minus z. Okay, so that's error, the difference between y and z. So we need a set of weights in the whole network that will make the sum squared error over the whole sample set, so y minus z squared, because it is sum squared error. We have seen that in the clustering case, the sum squared error. This should be small. So the sum of these squares for each x should be as small as possible. Hopefully the minimum, but you will see that getting the real minimum is not easy. Now, each weight in the network is independent from the others, and there are in total big W weights in the network, and we treat the error as a function of these weights. So you can imagine like 5 weights, so then you would have a function with 5 variables, because each of these weights is one variable of this error function. The error actually only depends on the weights given these inputs. Okay, let's have a break and then we continue explanation. Okay, 10 minutes break.
it's the aspect of the wireless communication. I really don't have it, something to experiment on. But it's
but there are intrusion detection for wireless.
Yeah?
There are intrusion detection system for wireless.
Okay.
That's also known. You can put it on Google, you will find many results. Intrusion detection in wireless networks. So you can put that and you will see that you will find many interesting things.
Wireless sensor network, but it will not appear like one paper for the two.
You must try to find the connection between what you are doing for your PhD and your detection. I think if you are doing wireless, then this could be okay.
Okay, let's continue. So we have said that the error function is the W dimensional, where W is the number of weights, total number of weights in the network. Okay? So for each point in the weight space, which means for each value of weights, any combination of weights, we can compute the error of the network over the training sample. Okay, so we browse the whole training sample and we compute any weights regarding this set of axes, and we get the sum square error, and that's actually a surface in a W dimensional space. Of course, we cannot draw that if W is greater than 2, but we are going to give you an example. So we want to get the combination of the weights that corresponds to the deepest valley on this multidimensional surface. That would be the best. So that would be the best combination of weights, which gives the minimum sum squared error. So how to get that? That's actually an optimization task on a multimodal function. Multimodal means the function with a lot of minima, but maybe not all are global. So that's difficult. We may get into a local minimum, not a global one. It depends on how this weight function looks like. A simple error surface for two weights would be something like that. We are looking for this point. So this combination of weights, the coordinates, will give the minimum of this function. So these weights put on the weights of our neural networks, and that will be the best, the smallest error. Now, if we have more than two weights, then you cannot draw that. This is a projection from a three-dimensional, and then three-dimensional is a projection for a four-dimensional, etc., etc. So how to get this local minimum? You always get a local minimum. If there were more than one in this head, reversed head, then you can imagine another one here, another head, you see? And this may be smaller. Then you may get here, which is not the best. The best is this one, the deepest one. So that's the multimodal. This is unimodal, just one minimum. But still, if you start from here, you may get to this point, but how? It depends. So how? We use descent methods. Actually, gradient descent. If a derivative of the error function with respect to the weights is known or can be estimated, so we can compute the derivative. That's why we need the derivative of the sigmoid function. Your homework. So you will see what is the error function and how we do it by means of gradient descent. So that's one method. You can use other methods, but they are more heuristic. So some hill climbing methods, because discrete optimization is a difficult problem. So there is no general solution. It's very often used in operations research. That's how it is called. Optimization of lengths of the pipelines and connections, etc. This is very often used there. Wherever you have to optimize something to find the best solution out of a lot of solutions, and you cannot compute these solutions. You have to estimate them. So we use gradient descent. And the function, this back propagation algorithm that we have mentioned, it is actually based on gradient descent. So what is gradient descent? Gradient is a vector. The ith component of the vector is the partial derivative of the error function with respect to this particular weight. Now, if we optimize this way, that's called the greedy algorithm. It goes to the maximum gain in error function. So, maximum drop of the value of error. If we do it this way. So it gives the maximum slope of the error function in the direction of the particular weight. A small change in weights then may give a great reduction of the error. That's why gradient descent is popular. Now, do it formally. So we have explained that in words and now with math. So suppose that Wij is the weight of the connection from the jth neuron in a lower level layer to the ith neuron in a higher level layer. This is worth explaining because the notation confuses people. So suppose we have like a network like this. All the connections, okay? Now, this is one level, this is another level, this is the third level. So we say Wij is the weight of the connection from the jth neuron in a lower level layer, like this. This is 1, 2, 3, this is 1, 2, this is 1. We label them like this. So jth neuron in a lower level layer. So this is lower level, this is higher level. Okay, now J is 2, for example, and the ith neuron in a higher level layer, like this one. So I is 2. So this here is Wij, 2, 2. So this confuses, you got used to that this would be a lower layer. This is actually a higher layer. Maybe this is not a good example because these two numbers are the same. So let's say that we consider this one, okay? So we say that this one, it's W, this is I, you see? I is 1 and J is 2. So this is W, I, J, 1, 2. Okay? So this is I and this is J. This is I, this is J. But I is here, higher level layer. So that confuses the students. But this is just a matter of convention. So we chose to use the notation from Kulkarni's book. Very good book, actually, highly recommended because it's not very heavy in mathematics. It's easy to understand. There are some maths, of course, but not as much as in other books. So highly recommended. Okay, so Wij is the width of the connection from the jth neuron in a lower layer and ith neuron in the higher level layer. Okay? Now, Ek is the error computed on the kth training pair xy. So we have labeled training samples. Eta is some constant. And the weight update by gradient descent is actually eta times the partial derivative of the error function on this particular weight. Okay, so that's the weight update by gradient descent, delta Wij. Don't restart my computer now, please. Oh, I cannot do it. This is crazy. Okay, you will see that the rest of the lecture. This here. Okay, sorry for this, but this is technical crazy things. No? Cannot snooze it any longer. Okay, then we have training based on this, on gradient descent. That's called backpropagation algorithm. So we are training the feedforward neural network, okay, like this. So that's actually a sequential implementation of gradient descent. So gradient descent was just one weight, okay? It only gives a local minimum of the error, as expected. So somewhere here, if you have more of these heads, you will get, you may get this one, but you may get this one. But it gives good results in many applications, including intrusion detection. Most often used training algorithm is this one for multi-layered neural nets. So, how does it work? Choose some initial values for the weights, random, for example, and the constant eta. Eta is never changed. Now, you have the training data set. Each sample from this training data set, you do this. You compute the total input, which is the sum xi, wi, to each neuron of the first layer, for example, this one. So you have features here. Okay, so our features are here. So total input is just one in the first layer, but here you will have more. So you compute the total input to each neuron on the first layer, and you propagate it to the output. So you compute, propagate to the output means compute the output of this and this, and then use them as input to this one, compute the output of this one, continue until you get the output of the whole network, which is Z. Now, go backwards. Starting from the output layer, compute the error for each neuron in that layer and propagate it backwards to the input layer. And on that way back, you adjust the weights according to these errors. Simple to say. However, in formulas, first we need some notation, but you will see the formulas are not very simple. So we have L layers in the network. Recall, three layers are enough for any model. So we have three layers, for example. L is most often equal to three. These networks are called shallow neural networks. So the others are deep, that have more than three layers. Okay? So we have L layers in general in the network. Then ui of small l is the total input to the neuron I in the layer L. And of course, L goes from 1 to big L. So big L is 3 in our case. So small l goes from 1 to 3. Okay, and then ui of L is the total input to the neuron I in the layer L. So we could say total input to the neuron 1 in the layer 2. That would be U1 of 2. Okay? Then Zi of L is the output of the neuron given this total input. So that's Zi of L. So that's this one, small z. And then Wij of L is the weight of the connection from the jth neuron in the layer L minus 1 to the ith neuron of the layer L. We have already explained that. Now, we use these backpropagation equations. Don't be afraid, you don't have to memorize this. So, delta is always the correction of the weight. So, delta Wij of L is this. Minus eta is a constant. Small delta I of L, Zj of L I minus 1. Now, this is the output, but this delta I is this. This part, which you see sigma prime of the total input. Sigma prime is the derivative of the sigmoid function times the sum of delta k of L plus 1 times delta wki of L plus 1. You see the next layer. Because we are going backwards. So since we are going backwards, then we compute this with the index L based on L plus 1, the previous layer, but going backwards. So we already have these values. So, sounds complicated, but it's actually not so complicated. So it's L goes from 1 to L minus 1. And then, for more than two classes, you would use delta I of L. That's the total error on output, but we are interested in this simple case for two classes. Delta of L is then sigma prime of U of L times Y minus Z of L. That's for two classes. Tomorrow we are going to practice this. We are going to give an example. With the values, you will see that for a human, it's terrible to compute that, but we are going to do that just for one single sample. And you will see there will be a lot of computation. However, a computer, it computes that very, very fast and in an easy way. So you don't have to memorize these formulas. So this is how you change the weights on the way back to the first layer. And that's called backpropagation algorithm. Classification is easy. Now you can consider W's, all the weights constant, and then you just compute the output given the sample. So that's how you train and test feed-forward neural networks. Now, what are the problems? We have explained this hype and how the enthusiasm grows and falls and all that. So why that? Because in our case of feed-forward neural networks, everybody expected that because theoretically it will solve all the problems. However, training is not easy. Training is, you see, it gives local minimum. That's the problem. Now, there is a tendency of these networks to form unstable configurations. So it doesn't converge for no apparent reason, even though theoretically it must converge. Okay? So it fails to learn certain things for no apparent reason. Then, the major drawback for utilizing it in intrusion detection is that, okay, it will give you good or bad. Okay, if you have two classes, you just need one neuron in the last layer. It gives you 0.1 when you set a threshold to 0.5. So what's the problem? The problem is that, okay, I get 0.1, but why I get 0.1? Nobody knows. So it's like if you remember these IDES and NIDES, you get the value that is beyond the threshold or below the threshold, but then what to do with this? So I know that something is bad with my system. However, where is the error? There is a lot of difficulties that will not help you to find out. So you have to dig deeply into the network to find, not neural network, but the network that you are trying to protect. So we get an indication of abnormality, which means an input instance vector is classified as bad by the neural network, but we do not know why it is bad. Now, we are going to give two examples of concrete systems that use actually neural network, among other things, that are used for intrusion detection. One is a bit older and one is a bit more recent. So any IDS that is used in practice is usually a combination of these techniques, of many learning methods, both supervised and unsupervised. Okay, so you can use clustering, you can use neural networks, you can use other methods that we have mentioned today, but neural networks are often used. So it's, of course, supervised learning, multi-layer network, we train it. Okay, that's why it is supervised. We use backpropagation algorithm to train because it's most often used algorithm. There are other algorithms you will see with deep learning that there are other. They are called optimizers. Okay. Then we get a local error minimum, not the global one. And since we get a local error minimum, which means that the error is not minimum, actually, it's a local minimum, not the global minimum, we get what? False positives, something that we don't like. Now, that's supervised learning. That is one part of this combination. Another part is unsupervised learning. We learned about clustering last time. One way of doing clustering is with neural networks as well, and that's called self-organizing map, or SOM. That's often used for initial classification and feature selection. We have said today that we can do feature selection by means of unsupervised method. Now, the first system that we are going to use to explain is Jacinto Rolli system from 2003-2004 that uses three abstraction levels that we have mentioned today, intrinsic, traffic, and content features. It is a multi-classifier approach, as we have shown on the slide, I think, 44. Then it uses three feed-forward, three-layer neural nets trained on distinct feature representations. 4 intrinsic, 7 content, and 19 traffic features of FTP traffic. So that was their data set, so they use it. It has 30 features in total, okay, of which 4 were intrinsic, 7 were content features, these are high level, and 19 traffic features that may be high or lower level of FTP traffic, not HTTP or something, but FTP, that's pretty old. Now, each neural network has the number of input layers, neurons, equal to the number of features, which is expected, 4, 7, and 19. So they use three nets. In the middle layer, they used 5 neurons. This middle layer is called hidden layer. Okay? 5 output layer neurons, because they have more classes, 5 classes. Normal, user-to-root, remote-to-local, port scanning, denial of service, so sounds... Some of them sound, but you will see next time we shall explain this user to root, remote to local. So these were used in KDD-CUP as well. Now, we can view at this as both anomaly or misused base. If we use all classes, it is misused base. If we join the attack classes, it will be anomaly based. So it's just good or bad. The combiner that they have tried was one of them, majority, that simple, Bayes in average and belief functions. All that we have already mentioned in general. So this was applied directly in Jacinto Rolli system. Now, in addition to this system that had three neural networks, each one for the particular set of input features, they used a reference system with a single three-layer feed-forward neural network with 30 neurons in the input layer, which are all the features, 4 plus 7 plus 19, so intrinsic, traffic, and these content features. Okay? Now, they used in this network 15 neurons in the hidden layer, and not all of them were, for example, in this second variant, not all of them were connected. So here you have the connection of each one with each one. You don't have to do that. If you have a lot of features, sometimes you can connect some group of neurons with another group of neurons in the next layer. But they used also the full variant, something like that, everything connected to everything. So each neuron of the input layer connected to all the 15 neurons of the hidden layer. So that was a big network. And then the second variant structured, for example, four intrinsic feature neurons fully connected to the first five neurons of the hidden layer, etc., etc. So that was something in between. And five neurons in the output layer. So we have 30, 15, 5. So a big network. And compared to the three networks, one with four input features, another with seven, and the third with 19. Now, this full system was a reference system with full structure, so everything connected to everything in the layer, by the layers. It performed best on the tested data with respect to detecting unknown attacks, which is anomaly detection, which was good. But the reference system, so you use a lot of neurons and a lot of connections, and at that time, 20 years ago, it was not easy to train because the performance of hardware was not so good as today. But the multiple classifier, the three neural networks, performed better compared with the full structure over known and unknown attacks taken together with respect to the true positive and false positive rate. So this was experimental work that was done on a concrete data set, which means it cannot be generalized. So we cannot generalize these results. Now, the reference structure variant, structure means that not everything here was connected for everything there, demonstrated similar performance compared to the multiple classifier. So you can use either big network with structured hidden layer or three separate networks. So the results were similar. So as we said, we cannot generalize these results since the differences between a single reference neural network classifier and the multiple classifiers are too small on the tested data. So we need more testing on different data set. And we need deeper study of the learning algorithm for the neural network. So why backpropagation? Now we have more knowledge. At that time, nobody talked about deep learning. So that's something from 2012 and on. So the last 10 years. The other system is a monster. It's very big. So this ADAT IDS, but that's more recent. So ADAT is adapted automatically tuning IDS, so very intelligent. So what is it doing? So the detection model or hypothesis is learned from the training data set. It has what is called a prediction engine, which analyzes and makes prediction, which is a classification, on each input data instance according to the detection model. Now, most of the prediction data are just logged, but if critical errors, then they are reported to the system operator to adjust the system, the parameters of the system. Now, given the prediction results that are automatically obtained, then the operator, which is a human in the loop, it investigates and verifies or not verifies the prediction results. If the prediction results are not verified, which means it's a false positive, then the false positives are sent to what they called fuzzy controller model tuner. Now, fuzzy means that you have to define a membership function for all entities, which means one entity, one vector, can belong to more than one class. That's fuzzy. Then this controller model tuner, fuzzy, it fine-tunes the model according to the feedback received from the operator, and that's why this system is adaptive. But the heart is this, the prediction engine. So the prediction engine says this vector is bad. Now the operator verifies that or not, okay, judged on his knowledge or her knowledge. And then if not, it's a false positive, then it is sent to this tuner that fine-tunes the model further. But this is after the training. So this prediction engine has to be trained. And that's this part. The detection model has to be built. How do we obtain the training set? We can use SOM for clustering raw data. This is cheap. And then we can verify by an expert. So if you remember, that's semi-supervised. Okay? So we get results from clustering, and then we get the guy that knows everything, and he or she says, this is good clustering, this is bad clustering, etc., etc. So this is corrected, and we get the combination that is better. And then we use pre-clustering to resolve for non-numerical data. So how do we cluster? So that's the question, because we may have numerical data in our vectors and non-numerical data, like TCP, UDP, ICMP, so this is not numerical. How can we do that? We actually partition the input set into the set of vectors that have TCP in common, those that have UDP in common, those that have ICMP in common. We run some on each of them, and then we reunite the results. So that's how we can resolve for non-numerical data, because comparison of vectors that contain non-numerical data cannot be done, because TCP, you cannot define distance between TCP and UDP. That doesn't make sense. We have already explained this. Now, we have a multiple classifier system that we have displayed earlier. And then we have the final decision function. In this ADAT IDS, it's called arbiter. So this arbiter has many strategies included. For example, you can use a neural network as an arbiter function, and this neural network can be trained as well. So this is really a complicated system. Then you get feedback tuning by means of fuzzy techniques, fuzzy prediction filter, and fuzzy tuning controller. We are not going into all the small details. This is just a global look at this ADAT system. The classification by means of this system with this prediction engine and then correction with this fuzzy controller model once trained, actually, they obtained excellent results on this famous KDD-CAP99 data set that nobody uses nowadays. However, there are derivatives of this that are still used, like NSL-KDD. We are going to explain that next week. Now, of course, KDD-CAP99, that's 24 years old already, from 1980, actually. It's not representative any longer, cannot be generalized, but it gives good results on other data sets as well. Now, this system, of course, as we have explained, is very complex. It requires difficult and costly tuning and requires a lot of resources for real-time operations. So you need hardware and you need to include the human in the loop that slows down the procedure. So that's a problem. The final part of this lecture we are going to dedicate to deep learning, of course, deep learning in IDS. But to explain deep learning in IDS, we have to explain deep learning first. Now, deep learning is a generalization of shallow learning, so a neural network with more than three layers, so that's simply said. Now, with three layers, we needed features. So not all the features, full feature set, we needed feature selection. And for this, we explained that we needed feature engineering, which takes a lot of effort and is expensive. Now, with deep learning, we use learning features directly from objects. That's how it is called, which makes feature engineering greatly simplified or, in the best case, unnecessary. So that would be very, very appreciated to have. However, to this, to complete, then we need a lot of resources. So billions of samples for training, and to process all this, since we have a lot of neurons that are placed in many layers and maybe complicated schemes of these layers, we need parallel architecture to implement, usually GPU in general or TPU. This is hardware specially produced by Google, Tensor Processing Unit, that is used for deep learning. You can buy that. Now, why deep learning? Because it exhibits better results than classical shallow neural nets and other classification methods, whether supervised and or unsupervised, but of course it cannot be generalized. So it is very good for image processing. For example, it has shown very good results on test data sets that are generally available. However, it can fail miserably on some tasks. So everything depends on training on the data. So this is data-driven processing. If you provide data that are not representative, as we have explained in the beginning of this session, then you get bad results. Now, with three layers and enough units in each layer, we can learn any function. We have already explained this. If we have more than three layers, the backpropagation algorithm can be used for optimization. So this is possible. We use the feedback signal originating from the error value here and backpropagate it to the input layer by gradually making changes to the weights. However, if you have more than three layers, the signal gets weaker and weaker of error. So it is actually damped. So it fades away with more than three layers. That's the problem. That's why it has been considered for a long time that more than three layers using makes no sense, because with three layers you can learn any function. Okay? So why should we be interested in neural networks with more than three layers? First of all, the role of any layer is actually a more adequate representation of data. As we add layers, we get a better and better representation of data, hopefully. So that's the goal. So if we have more layers, we get better representation of data, which gives more accurate final classification. However, as we said, the error signal fades away. So that's the problem. Now, in shallow networks, which is three-layer networks, we have classical activation sigmoid or hyperbolic tangent function, most often sigmoid, but sometimes this one as well. The number of epochs needed for training can be very large with these. Okay? Consequence, slow training, so it can take long time to get minimum error. Now, with more than three layers, we achieve more efficient training and more accurate classification, but we have to solve the problem of this error signal fading away after more than three layers. How can we do that? We use special activation function, not any longer sigmoid or hyperbolic tangent. We use ReLU, or rectified linear unit. That's pretty new, like 10 years. So it's simple. It's maximum 0x. So if x is smaller than 0, then 0. If it is greater than 0, then x. So that's very simple. That's here it's y equal to x, and here it's 0 on this part. In addition, we use new weight initialization schemes, not random. We can use layer-wise pre-training. We can use many other techniques. So a lot of experiments have been done and some theoretical considerations. And we do not use just back propagation. We use new optimizers, how they call them. New optimization schemes are like RMS-Prop, ADA-GRAD, ADAM. So they are all known. We shall see tomorrow in the exercise that we use systems that can, you just say, I want RMS-Prop, for example, and it's already implemented. You don't have to. We are going to use Keras. Keras is the layer above TensorFlow. Now, basic concept of deep learning, we have to explain what a tensor is, what a rank is, what a shape is, etc., to understand deep learning. So what is a tensor? Tensor is an array of certain dimensions, not a tensor from mathematics. So you have heard about tensors, but not, it's not this. So tensor in this terminology is an array of certain dimensions. So, for example, ZOD tensor is a scalar. It's a number. 1D tensor is a vector. 2D tensor is a matrix, etc. So that's... Now, rank is dimensionality of a tensor, so number of axes. You see, tensor has axes. So 1D tensor, the rank is 1. 2D tensor, the rank is 2, etc. That's easy. Now, shape. Shape is the dimensionality of each axis of a tensor. So 2D tensor with 3 rows and 5 columns, so 2D tensor is a matrix, as we said. So 2D tensor with 3 rows and 5 columns, it has shape 3, 5. Easy thing. A scalar has empty shape, you see. Now, you will need these concepts to program Keras in the exercise. Examples of tensor. For example, if you have vectors, a batch of vectorial data is 2D tensor, not 1D. And why is that? Because it's always this X samples. So it's always, so you always have 1 plus the number of dimensions, okay? So 2D tensor you need for vectorial data, 3D tensor for time series data, which is a matrix, timestamps features, okay? But you have also samples. So samples is, let's say, ordinal numbers, 0, 1, 2, 3, etc. It's very easy, but it has to be put in the tensor. Then image data is a 4D tensor, not 3D tensor. And video data is a 5D tensor, not a 4D tensor. So you have frames, height, width, channels, but also samples. So this is just an ordinal number of the sample. So these are examples of tensors. What is a batch? You know, with shallow learning, we train the system on the whole data set, but not with deep learning. With deep learning, we use subsets called batches. So they are divided into smaller parts, and they are called data batches. The first axis, axis 0 of any tensor, is the samples axis, as we have explained. And the optimization algorithm, optimizers, they operate on batch data instead on the whole data set. But you can define that you want it on the whole data set if you like. Now, how do we train? It's called a training loop. We use a batch of training samples X and their labels Y. So we have the data set, so a lot of data, and then we divide that into batches. Then we initialize the weights, sometimes to random values, actually often, but we can use other methods, new weight initialization schemes. Then we use the forward pass, compute the output of the network, that's called Y prime, and then compute the loss function on the current batch. It's a measure of mismatch between Y and Y prime. In the single case of perceptron, we have Y minus Z. With shallow network, also Y minus Z, but we can use more complicated loss functions, and there are reasons for that. And then we update the weights to reduce the loss. We use the optimizer. The optimizer can be the backpropagation, if we like, but we can use RMS-Prop, we can use ADA-GRAD, we can use ADAM, and other optimizers. There are many. Now we select the parameters of the model. We use the last layer activation function sigmoid for a two-class problem. That's recommended. We are interested in two-class problems, just one neuron in the output layer, because we have good or bad. That's in IDS basic problem. Now the loss function selection for a two-class problem, we use binary cross entropy. We are not going to explain what it is. You will see, you just say, I want binary cross entropy. There are other loss functions, like difference can be a loss function. And then we use optimizer. For example, RMS prop is very popular. And we can use, we in Keras that we are going to use tomorrow in the exercise, we actually just say that it is RMS prop or Adam or Adagrad. So we can use, that's like if you have ever used tech and LaTeX to write documents. So LaTeX is a layer above tech, which is very complicated to use low level. Also here, so you have TensorFlow, which is complicated, but it of course gives you more possibilities. However, if you want very general, then use Keras. That's very easy to program. In Python, of course. Okay, so that was very, very basic about what is deep learning. Okay, now how can we use that in IDS? So you need a lot of training samples, so hundreds of millions. But you get better prediction of, for example, unknown malware. It has been done in practice. For example, the U.S. military, this DARPA, they have cyber genome program, which uncovers the, let's say, DNA of malware and other cyber threats by deep learning. So that's what they have done. However, this is not exactly IDS. It's malware detection. So it analyzes executable files, not traffic. But of course, this can be generalized, and this can be used to analyze traffic as well. Now here, and you have this paper in our doc section in Blackboard. You can read this paper, of course, but I'm going to just summarize what they have done. So this system is called SHIA. So it's Scale Hybrid IDS Alert Net. So they have built that. It's deep learning. So it learns the abstract and high-dimensional feature representation of the IDS data by passing them into many hidden layers. But this is very special structure. They used KDD Cup again, which is not a good idea, actually. For today, you should use other data sets, but they have used others as well. So in next week, we are going to see that this KDD Cup 99, it has 41 feature. Because of that, input layer has 41 neuron, which is the number of features. Then they had five fully connected hidden layers. So input layer, 41 features. Then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 fully connected, so each with each, a very complicated structure, hidden layers with ReLU activation function, not sigmoid. So each fully connected layer is followed by two special layers for batch normalization and regularization. So we are not going into details of this. However, so you have five layers. After each of these five, you have two. So it's 5 times 3, that's 15, isn't it? Yeah, 15 layers in total. Output layer, one neuron if binary classification. And this one is, as recommended, sigmoid activation, not ReLU. The loss function is binary cross entropy for a two-class problem, that's recommended as well. The optimizer is Adam, not RMS prop, which is most often used for Adam was used here. And the resulting IDS framework is called Scale Hybrid IDS Alert Net, which uses the deep learning neural network for classification, and the rest of the framework captures traffic and or system calls, if we are talking about host-based intrusion detection, and it generates input features for the deep learning network. Well, that would be all for today, just in time. And then tomorrow we do the exercise.
very recent data set.
Sorry?
Yeah, I'm talking of like this Canadian data set.
Ah, NSLKDD, yeah.
Yeah, but it's very large. It's like 20 gig.
There are many. I think they have like 30 data sets. So if you are talking about NSLKDD, it is smaller than KDD Cup. It is. We are going to talk about that next week. I'm going to explain.
Okay. So
some attacks have been removed from that.
Okay. Do we have like a platform where we can do training with our students here?
Maybe this Sky High. That's the cloud. But you have to talk to the engineers, to the IT department, to give you the permission to use Sky High. That's the cloud solution that we have. Okay, so see you tomorrow in the exercise.
Yeah, I will come with something for that tomorrow. So that's
yeah, so it's very important that you give me the topic.